All right. Well, good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And I'm hearing some noise on the line, but Representative Schumacher, that might be you. Oh, good. Thank you very much. All right. So we're going to start this afternoon by taking the roll as we usually do. And members, please mute your feeds and just unmute when you need to respond to the roll call, if you would. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Bonner, present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Dameth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel.
Present. Present.
Munson. Oh, wait, Morrison, sorry.
Present.
Munson. Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. So with that, members, I need a motion to approve the minutes of February 2nd, just yesterday. Representative Bolden, could you move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Bolden moves approval of the minutes of February 2nd. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please unmute yourselves, members, for a moment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. All right, thank you. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Very good. So first, I know that we're all excited to hear from Dr. Osterholm. I see he's already with us today. But before we get to his presentation, we want to start out today hearing a little bit about local public health. And just to make sure that everybody's familiar with them, what they do, and then we are going to hear, a brief bill presentation from Representative Wolgamott. And members, for those of you who, I'm not sure if we've actually done this before in this committee, but we will be laying this over for possible inclusion in our finance bill. So no vote on the bill today, just so everyone's aware. So with that, I'm going to first call on our presenters. We have David Brummel from Washington County Public Health.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Labeling.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Chair Labeling and members of the committee, my name is David Brummel. I am the Deputy Director at Washington County Department of Public Health and Environment. Currently, I serve as the incident commander for our local COVID-19 response. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota, otherwise known as LPHA. My colleagues and I are here today to talk about local public health response to COVID-19. Local health departments have stepped up in remarkable ways during this pandemic, and I'm proud to work alongside my colleagues across the state to respond to this pandemic. We've been working 7 days a week for nearly a year to protect the health of our communities. Responding to public health emergencies and preventing the spread of infectious disease are part of our core services. We've spent years building partnerships, planning response strategies, training our staff, and practicing our response activities. One of our biggest focuses right now is, of course, delivering vaccine. Long before the COVID-19 pandemic, local public health was working with community partners to identify sites and establish plans to vaccinate individuals. We use these local connections to quickly stand up services. With the limited doses we have received, we've hosted 21 clinics since December 29th, and we've provided vaccinations to first responders, healthcare staff, community COVID vaccinators and testing staff, child care workers, and education staff. In addition, our department has also contracted with Bluestone Physician Services to vaccinate long-term care facility residents and staff within Washington County. Next, I want to talk about case investigations and contact tracing. This strategy is used to help notify those who have been in contact with someone who have tested positive for COVID-19 so they can stay at home during the infectious period to prevent further spread of the virus. Since May 7th, our staff have been working 7 days a week to contact individuals for case investigation and contact tracing. During our peak case weeks, we handled an average of 86 cases per day, handling a total of over 5,000 cases to date. I would like to quickly read a short email we received from one individual we contacted through case investigation and contact tracing. I want to express my humble appreciation for all of the services that your office has offered during this time. I was called immediately by a public health nurse who provided me comfort and assurance that everything would be all right. Her kind words calmed my nerves and allowed me to have peace of mind, as both of our children were also COVID positive. The public health nurse made sure that I knew what services were available, and staff contacted me to make sure that we would have food as we social distance. I never knew exactly what those in public health do, but now I understand. Our recovery has been so positively impacted by the things your office provides. In this short message, this email, the individual also expressed thanks for another service we provide called Essential Services. Local public health provides resources to those who are in isolation or in quarantine as a result of COVID-19. These essential services can include delivery of food or cleaning supplies, masks or thermometers, delivery of prescription medication, and connection to other resources. Since the beginning of the pandemic, county staff have worked 7 days a week to fill nearly 500 essential service requests. Local public health also regularly works to support mental well-being in our communities. We frequently partner with local agencies in this mission. For example, we partnered with Forest Lake YMCA to connect seniors living in the area. The YMCA placed over 13,000 calls to 2,600 seniors between April 1st of 2020 and January 8th, 2021. These calls supported seniors during the challenging months of the pandemic lockdown, helping reduce isolation and combating the associated health risks, including depression and well-being. Last, I would like to briefly touch on our communication efforts. Local agencies are tasked with sharing accurate information with our communities. During the pandemic, we launched a local COVID-19 online data portal to provide local information on COVID-19 case rates and infectious data. We also launched what we call a Face This Together webpage and social media campaign, providing information at the local level related to the COVID-19 response. In addition, our local constituents call us first. They depend on us when they have questions. Our staff take great pride in answering these phone calls. Our staff respond with empathy, compassion, and local information in this difficult time. In conclusion, thank you for taking the time to hear about Washington County's experience in the COVID-19 response. We look forward to continuing to work collaboratively with you to protect the health of our communities.
Thank you, Mr. Brummel. We appreciate your presentation. And I'm going to go to the other two presenters, and then we'll take questions from members if there are any questions at that point. Sarah Chono, welcome. If you would just introduce yourself, please, and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Chono, and I am the Public Health Director for Norman and Mahnomen Counties. Responding to this pandemic has been challenging, but we are making our way through. Your support of our work and our infrastructure is crucial to help us make it to the other side of this and return back to normal. For my small health department and for my colleagues across the state, one of our largest struggles has been maintaining a level of staffing that enables a prolonged response to the pandemic while keeping up with our other local public health services. In fact, LPHA recently did a survey of local health departments across the state, and we found that 88% of local public health agencies reported stopping or curtailing activities as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, including family home visiting and environmental health activities. We are working to maintain services and playing catch up to hire and train new staff while also working to respond and deliver vaccinations. Strong investment in local public health infrastructure will be key to continuing response and to plan for future emergencies. Our largest strength in the COVID-19 response is our deep knowledge of resources in our own communities. The people I am working to protect are my friends and neighbors. They know me personally. Many of them have my cell phone number, or at least they do by now. And they know I will pick up their call to answer their questions, whether it's 6 a.m. or 10 p.m. at night. I am the face of my local health department, and my community members know they can call me and they trust me. As Dave did earlier, I thought it would be helpful to share some of the activities my health department and those across the state have put into place to respond to COVID-19. Incident Command. My agency, like the others across the state, is leading in our incident command structures to respond to COVID-19. In Menominee County, we have a joint county and tribal emergency manager, which has been extremely beneficial for a coordinated response. Menominee County is located entirely within the boundaries of the White Earth Nation Reservation, so our partnership and coordination has been vital to serving our communities. In Norman County, we have a Department Operations Center and have frequent communications with multiple partners, including our partners in Polk County, as we are part of the Polk Norman Menominee Community Health Board. In both of our counties, we hold regular, often daily or weekly meetings with other incident command staff, internal and external partners. This provides us the opportunity to work together, monitor the situation, and plan and develop policies. Our incident command oversees many parts of their response, including business education and support, setting up testing events, ensuring continuity of operations, coordinating contact investigation and tracing, and now setting up and delivering vaccinations. These structures also enable regular communication and support our long-term care, congregate living facilities, hospitals, faith communities, and childcare, among other partners. School coordination. We are also working closely with our schools to make sure they are safe for both our staff and students. In our counties, our public health nurses are also the school nurses. We meet weekly with our school superintendents and nurses, providing current data trends and situational awareness. Our local public health staff are also doing the school contact investigation and tracing for both the academic setting and for youth sports. Most of our schools have been able to maintain in-person education for elementary and hybrid for high school, and we attribute that success to our strong local plans and partnerships. We are also continuing to explore innovative ways to deliver services in the era of social distancing. Throughout the pandemic, we have ramped up telehealth options for new moms and their babies in family home visiting programs. WIC, which is Women, Infants, and Children programs, and Min Choices and Long-Term Care Consultations for seniors. Ensuring continued access to these programs keeps our seniors and families safe, healthy, fed, and connected to their local resources. And lastly, vaccinations. We spend time each and every year planning for and delivering vaccines. We regularly host flu shot clinics each year, and we know what works best for our local communities. Now that the COVID-19 vaccine is available, we play a key role in educating the community and delivering those vaccines. We are preparing for and hosting vaccine delivery events in our communities using the guidance and prioritization from the federal and state government. Our local health departments have done a lot to meet people where they're at, setting up events in various locations and at various times across our communities so they are accessible to our constituents. We are also coordinating closely with our healthcare partners, and we're able to vaccinate our assisted living residents and our group home residents and staff. For my health department, because of our small size, I also get to be one of the people providing those vaccinations. As we are vaccinating, I get to see the relief and hope people experience as they are being vaccinated. One of the best days I've had in a long time was last month when we hosted our first vaccination clinic for our phase 1A community members, and also our essential caregivers for long-term care. People were so excited and grateful to have the opportunity to receive the vaccine. They were literally dancing down our hallways. We are prepared to continue vaccinating our community members locally as we receive additional vaccine. Thank you for your time and your support of our work.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chono. It's a nice image, people dancing down the hallway after getting a vaccine. I like that. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Susan Palchik, Welcome. If you would just introduce yourself, please, and go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Palchik, and I am the Public Health Director for Hennepin County. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. Responding to COVID-19 has enabled us to build upon decades of public health emergency response planning, training, and exercising, and real-world experience, such as responding to emergencies like H1N1, TB, natural disasters, and now COVID-19. Each of our local public health departments across the state are unique, as are the communities we serve. But we're all working to implement similar activities in ways that best serve our communities. I'll use my time today to share a little of what we've learned in the response in Hennepin County. In Hennepin, like many other counties, the core of our approach and a key to our success has been our emphasis on community engagement. We work hard to engage our communities, each with specific needs and concerns. It was apparent to us from the beginning that the longstanding and persistent health inequities that already plagued our communities would be compounded by COVID-19, and our data sadly bear this out. Because COVID was disproportionately impacting some of our communities, especially Black, Latino, and American Indian communities, we understood that engaging with them early and authentically would be essential in fighting this pandemic. Community engagement is a priority countywide in Hennepin County, and partnership is critical because it helps us to do big and important work to protect the community's health. All local health departments in Minnesota play a critical role as community conveners. We can't solve all the problems by ourselves, but public health departments understand our role in bringing together the right folks in the communities to get the work done. Following the listen and respond approach, we learned as early as last spring that many of our communities were desperate for masks. The county was able to hear this concern and respond. I won't go into all the logistics and the procurement efforts, but thanks to our engagement approach, we have so far distributed over 1.7 million masks, and we're continuing to do so. Community-based organizations put in an order for what they need, and then we fill those orders. Another aspect of our response has been testing. Again, community engagement was instrumental in fine-tuning our testing strategy. We were able to respond to community requests for testing events in their communities. Our department learned important lessons through testing, and we are applying those lessons to the vaccine rollout. Another role is epidemiological surveillance. We're fortunate to employ a team of skilled and experienced epidemiologists. We track and monitor where case outbreaks are happening to understand how the virus is traveling and who is impacted so we can work within those communities to limit spread. An example of that is the work with businesses such as licensed food establishments. Our environmental health inspectors aren't just out there enforcing the governor's executive orders. They're working with business owners in our communities, providing education, support, and guidance to help those businesses weather the pandemic while keeping the community healthy and safe. Local health departments like ours serve as an incubator for ideas and innovation that benefit not just our own communities, but the statewide public health system. One example is our epidemiology team has offered key feedback to MDH on the case investigation and contact tracing surveys that led to improvements to streamline the surveys and shorten it, and therefore increase compliance. Supporting local health departments doesn't just help the individual departments, it helps us each help each other to ensure a stronger statewide system. And building on a little bit of what my colleagues have already shared with you, in vaccinations, we understand that our role is to make sure that people and groups who don't have other options to get the vaccine, whatever the reason, whether it's lack of assurance, lack of access to a healthcare provider, fear, mistrust, or misinformation, that it's our responsibility to fill that gap. We must work harder and more creatively to reach these groups to get vaccinated. And this is yet another way that we put engagement at the core of our efforts. There have been challenges in vaccine distribution at the local level. And we are in active conversation with the state about these challenges, and we understand that some of them are beyond their control. But from the local perspective, these challenges include that we need better data, better demographic data, race and performance data on the county level. And also, local public health wants to be perceived as a true partner with MDH and the SEOC in vaccine allocation and distribution with an equity lens. So in closing, we're likely to see lingering effects of the pandemic for years to come. For example, we've seen increases in mental health challenges, food insecurity, and substance misuse. Fewer kids are getting their routine vaccinations, so we could see increases in infectious disease outbreaks in the coming years. We already know that the pandemic has worsened the opioid epidemic in Minnesota. We're experiencing a pandemic now, but looking into the future, there will be upcoming challenges, and local public health will play an important role in responding. So it's crucial to build up public health infrastructure to enable a strong response to the next public health emergency or pandemic. Thank you for providing us the opportunity to speak with you today, and we are all happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much, Ms. Palchik. Appreciate it. We do have a couple of questions for members. I think I saw Representative Freiberg first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question might be best for Ms. Palchik. She mentioned that childhood vaccinations have gone down since the pandemic started. I guess I'm just wondering if that's been quantified, and you know what the percent, you know what percentage aren't getting their routine vaccinations that would have in a prior non-pandemic year.
Yeah, Ms. Palchik.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but we could get those pulled from the state immunization registry.
Sure. Okay. I'd be interested in seeing those if you're able to. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question could be for, I think, both Ms. Palchik and Ms. Jono. First, I want to thank you for all of your work at the county level and all the work that public health does for all of us, some of the hardest working people I know doing the jobs you're doing. So thank you for that. But my question is, you know, in light of COVID-19 kind of dominating the landscape of what you're doing, my question is, what do you think are the most significant things that are being left undone? You mentioned some of the issues that have gotten worse, but what are the issues that just are kind of falling by the wayside and off the radar with the extent of the work you have to do around COVID right now? What are your number one concerns?
So Representative Bierman, did you want to direct that to, we have kind of three different representative public health departments here. Who would you like to ask?
Well, let's ask Ms. Palchik, who is the last one.
All right, Ms. Palchik.
Madam Chair, Representative, so that's what I get for going last. So I think a lot of it is, I think the things that have gotten left undone are more the how we've done things. So with some of the things that we've had to do virtually, that they're just, some of the family home visiting is not as rich as it was. Some of the waivers that are in place have enabled to do things remotely that's really helped, but it's still not quite the same. So, I just off the top of my head, I would say probably the family home visiting is one of the areas where we're missing that touch that we haven't had before. I mean, that we did have before, sorry.
Okay. Madam Chair, maybe one follow-up then, too.
Fairman.
Just in terms of going forward, you mentioned the needs of getting ready for the next events and what would strengthen public health. What are those issues that are foremost in mind?
Ms. Palchik?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think just continuing to build and strengthen the infrastructure so that we're ready to respond. I think, like Sarah said, that some health departments have really had to decrease their staffing and to have to build that up and train people and get them experience in the height of an epidemic or a pandemic or an outbreak is really difficult. So it's just, it's made building and maintaining that infrastructure.
All right. Thank you so much. So we'll take one more question from Representative Keel, and then we will go to Representative Wolgamott for his bill. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to extend my thanks to all of our public health representatives here today. Members, I would like to emphasize, I've had a lot of conversations with one of my public health directors. We actually text now rather than call each other. So there's a lot of that going on. And I think it's a service that's always there. And what I like about the fact that we went back to using our public health for vaccines, because that kind of walked away from our public health, and then it was decided it came back into that service, is those are people we know, especially in our smaller counties, very personally. And so they can recognize if there's problems, issues, much more quickly than someone that comes in from another situation, a larger part of the state. And those are really important things when we're watching, especially our seniors who don't come out very often and then do. And then when Representative Bierman asked what we were missing, I can tell you one thing. My public health nurses do a nail care for senior citizens, and it was months before they could get that part of it back up and running. So I'd say a lot of services that they do on a regular basis that they either couldn't do because of staffing or because of COVID, that attachment. And those are really missed, and I'm really glad we're back to doing those things. So I'd hope we'd rethink how we shut things down just because we lacked a lot of services that we needed. And I know Mr. Brummel, Sarah Cogno, and Ms. Palchik worked really hard, and I thank you. This has got to be a record book for how many hours you guys all put in. But thank you very much for your work.
Yeah, thank you so much, Representative Keel. So we're going to go to Representative Wolgamott. I would just comment, thank you to the three presenters. You know, we hear the term public health infrastructure a lot. And I think I just understood from all three of you, I think a lot of what that means is that you've got people who have relationships throughout your community. And so when a need comes upon you, you already have those relationships in place. You know your community. You know where the needs are. You have the contacts in the community. You don't have to build them from scratch. So thank you. I add my thanks to that of Representative Keel and all of us that you do such great work. Representative Wolgamott, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. So Representative Wolgamott is going to move that House File 428 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So, Representative Wolgamott, go ahead and present your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Liebling, and thank you to all my fellow committee members for your time this afternoon. I am presenting House File 428, which will increase funding for the local public health grant by $20 million per year. The local public health grant is the state's main investment in services mandated to local public health by state statute. These mandates include assuring an adequate public health infrastructure, promoting healthy communities and healthy behaviors, preventing the spread of infectious diseases, that really hits home, protecting against environmental health hazards, preparing for and responding to disasters and assisting communities in recovery, and assuring the quality and accessibility of health services. It provides flexible funding to local governments so that they can direct funding to address specific needs in their communities. Local public health services are funded by a combination of federal, state, and local dollars. Local tax levies have increasingly carried the burden of meeting state mandates and communities' expanding needs. Madam Chair and members, this over-reliance on levies, unstable grant funding, a series of funding cuts at the state and federal level, and funding not keeping up with inflation have combined to stress the local public health system, limiting capacity to carry out core services and respond to infectious disease threats, like, for example, the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as tuberculosis or measles, and emerging public health issues like mental health, opioid use, and disparities in social determinants of our health. Investing in prevention services through local public health pays off by saving health care and other public program costs. This bill will help to restore local public health capacity to maintain state-mandated services, respond to local needs, and relieve local tax levies. So with that, Madam Chair, that is the essence of the bill that I'm putting forward and why I'm putting it forward. And with that, I'd like to introduce Graham Briggs, the Public Health Director for Olmsted County, who will provide testimony on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. And I do see we have a hand up, but you know what? If it's okay, Representative Munson, I'm going to wait till we're done with the testifier. Would that be all right? All right. Thank you. All right. Well, Mr. Briggs, who happens to be from my own county, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Graham Briggs, B-R-I-G-G-S, and I am the Director of Olmsted County's Public Health Department. I'm here on behalf of the Local Public Health Association, otherwise known as LPHA. LPHA represents local public health leaders across the state of Minnesota. Our local public health agencies serve all Minnesota residents from before birth until after death. We strive to understand health issues at the local level and work to both prevent negative impacts while promoting access to health for all of our residents, from coordinating local partnerships, addressing mental health, to limiting the impact due to COVID-19. We are on the front lines of protecting the health of our communities. Local public health is mandated by statute to fulfill several key roles for our state. Some of these important activities include tracking health, using local data to understand everything from the leading causes of death to local risk factors, from salmonella to obesity. This allows us to develop strategies to address local issues at the community level. We are charged with developing and maintaining response plans as the on-the-ground first responders to community-level disasters and emergencies. Across this country, local public health agencies investigate cases and outbreaks of infectious disease to eliminate risk for residents, including for COVID-19. We're also alongside other first responders on site to assess and respond to the impact related to natural disasters like tornadoes, floods, and earthquakes. Local public health is also best suited to address issues related to equity and social determinants of health due to the relationships that we have with local partners and within the community. Unfortunately, over the last 15 years, we have witnessed a slow crumbling of our local public health infrastructure. The field of public health is about investing in prevention, which can sometimes take a back seat to the issue of the day. However, the American Public Health Association states that for every dollar invested in public health, $5.60 is saved in future health spending. Every dollar spent on childhood vaccinations saves us $16.50 in downstream health costs. However, only about 3% of spending on healthcare goes to public health and prevention efforts in the United States. In Minnesota alone, over $47 billion a year is spent on healthcare costs. Each year, MDH puts together an expenditure summary for local public health. The most recent report from 2018 revealed that more than half, or 51%, of expenses are locally generated. The largest portion of this is local tax levy dollars. Federal funds contribute to the next largest share at 34%, but that has also been declining. Minnesota's federal funding to prepare for emergencies, for example, has been cut from nearly $16 million in 2002 to $9.2 million in 2019. In Olmsted County, this has meant that we've been using local tax levy for a portion of the one employee that we have that prepares our public health department to respond to emergencies. Without this position before and now during the pandemic, we would have had no plans, no training, and no response infrastructure when the pandemic hit. State funds make up 15% of local public health funding in Minnesota. The local public health grant is the state's main investment in our local public health system, yet it accounts for 6.2% of funding and has decreased as a percentage of expenditures over time. This funding covers only a fraction of our costs. For example, Olmsted County typically has fully utilized our allocation of the LPHG by the end of the first quarter each year. Flexible funding is crucial to our local public health system, as many state mandates and core public health services are not well supported by categorical grants. It allows local governments to direct dollars most and to better address the diverse needs of Minnesota communities. Public health and prevention work requires investment to lower morbidity and costs long term. Just like you can't build a fire truck and hire firefighters after the fire has already started, local public health requires long-term investment. We need to build the system both to prevent small fires from happening and to protect us before the next big fire comes. I want to thank you for your time and consideration today, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Briggs. And the one thing before I move on to Representative Munson, I was just checking to see what we got for documents today, and some of the figures you gave us about, I don't know if you'd be the right person to give them to us, but if you have anything that you could send us after the fact about the portion of the funding that comes from the various sources, I think that would be really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question, I guess, would be to Representative Wolgamont on this bill. When I was looking into the Minnesota statute, so 145A.131, that talks about the local public health grant funding, I noticed that the funding allocations are based on 2003 numbers or 17-year-old data. And I'm wondering, when this public health grant money, it requires at least a 75% match from local funds in order to receive any of this money. Doesn't that kind of widen the gap between the wealthy and the economic challenged communities? Because you're requiring maybe the communities that need this money most to come up with matching funds. And your bill doesn't really have any limitations on, it doesn't really direct where the money goes. It just puts more money into this public health grant fund, which is, you know, a good thing for local communities that need it. But what I just wanted to get your opinion on how these funds are going to be used and how they're going to be directed.
So thank you, Representative Munson. I wonder if Mr. Briggs would be more able to answer that question. Mr. Briggs, could you take a stab at that one?
Well, I can say the amount of funding that we get from the local public health grant is a small percentage of our overall funding. I can't really comment on the writing and current statute as far as how that is requiring the money to be split up, but that is something I can talk to LPHA about and get back to the group on as well.
Okay, and I'm looking to see if our fiscal analyst is here on the call, but I don't see him. I don't think Mr. Berg is here, but that would be a person who we, oh, yep. There he is.
Yes. I am here.
Great. Mr. Berg, can you address that at all? Like, what, could you repeat that, Representative Munson? I don't know if Mr. Berg got your...
Sure. Under the Minnesota statute, that 145A.131, there's a requirement under subdivision 2 that the local community health board is required to provide at least a 75% match for state funds. And my question is, you know, as we put money into this fund, communities that have a larger ability to raise money through local sales tax or through property tax would be, you know, would maybe apply for these funds, whereas more economically challenged communities would have a harder time matching those funds, and maybe those communities need it more. I was just wondering if the current statute works against economically challenged communities to receive this money.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I mean, it certainly could be the case that they would work against them. I cannot say specifically if there's a problem. That statute goes back well before I dealt with Human Services. In the time I have been dealing with this, I believe the local public health grant level has been static since certainly since fiscal 12, I believe, and the grant amount has not changed in the total amount has not changed in that time. So I think what the testimony you heard earlier, that the local funding and the federal funding out outside of the state has grown while the state share of that has remained static for the last 8 years. So I don't know if that translates to any, that there's anybody who can't raise that money, but when the share is going down, it's because the state's just been staying in one place and local funds have gone up.
Okay. So, all right. Well, you know what? That might be a good issue to continue to explore, Representative Munson, and there's no saying that you couldn't do a bill to change the way the money's allocated in statute. So we'll look forward to that. So I have a couple other members on the list. We only have 5 minutes left, so I want to just make sure everybody knows that. So we've got Ryer and then Backer. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to piggyback, actually, on Representative Munson's question, because I was thinking about disparities as well, but my angle was thinking about local levies and just how we see with education, some communities can't afford levies and others cannot, and so that reinforces disparities. So from that point of view, I think that looking at statewide funding is a good step. I am curious what our allocation has been in past years as a first term. It's $20 million. What share increase is that?
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, the current base, general fund base for the local public health grant is $21.665 million annually.
Thank you. Representative Ryer? Good. Okay. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I don't know who can answer this, but, you know, we have talked about the effectiveness of public health. And as an EMT, I get that. But has there been, and maybe you may know this, Chair, or someone else, in the last couple of years, looking at how this grant, we've been doing this grant for many years, or a public health grant, I should say, how the effectiveness of getting it to the right county government, per se. And I'm not aware of any. I don't know if anybody can answer that, if there's anything out there in the marketplace, on the effective of getting the money to the right people.
So, Representative Backer, I'm not exactly sure if I understand the question. Are you concerned about how the money's distributed among the various local public health departments? Is that kind of the question?
Yeah, pretty much, because there are, there are in the inner urban area and also in greater Minnesota, there's different needs and they don't have the tax capacity to fund those departments. So it would be interesting to see proportion. I don't know if one of the departments could get it to us, to me, just understanding it's getting to the right point.
Yeah, so
kind of more of a comment.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe we could get some more information on that offline. That would not be a bad thing to sort of see how the money's been distributed. Maybe, if Mr. Briggs, if you could get that for us after the fact, and if that's available to you, or maybe Mr. Berg, I think that would be
appreciated
to know. Thank you, Representative Backer. All right. Well, with that, seeing no further questions, Representative Wolgamott is going to renew his motion that House File 428 be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance bill, and the bill is laid over. So thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, members.
All right. So now, members, we are going to move to our presentation from Dr. Osterholm. And welcome to the committee, Dr. Osterholm. We are really thrilled. We know, I was thinking of that old joke about an expert being from 50 miles away. And you are not from 50 miles away, but you are definitely an expert. And we're really thrilled to have you here today and to talk to us about the pandemic that is just so much on everybody's minds. And so with that, I would just ask you to just state your name for the record and tell us where you're from, and then go ahead and tell us what you want us to know.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to be here. I'm Michael Osterholm. I direct the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that, I served at the State Health Department for 25 years, many of those years as a state epidemiologist. It's worth noting that this week, as I went back and checked, is actually my 40th anniversary of testifying before the Health Committee in the House in the state of Minnesota. Originally in 1981, I testified before Representative Lee Greenfield, and that time it was the House and Welfare Committee, on this new strange disease that was coming that one day we'd understand it to be HIV/AIDS. And since that time, I've testified many, many, many times before you. And I must say, every time is still as much a privilege as it was the last time. So thank you for having me and for the opportunity to share with you this situation we're in today. I'll just make a few general comments to say that, first of all, I have a disclosure to make that I think is pretty important. I think I know less about this virus today than I did 8 weeks ago. And I think that anyone who doesn't acknowledge the period of we're in right now and what we know about what's happening or not happening wouldn't be honest with you. This is a very humbling experience. Having said that, we've been pretty much at our center on target throughout the entire pandemic. Last January 20th, I put out a statement saying that this would, in fact, be the next pandemic, that we needed to get ready for it. In early February, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying, wake up, world, we got to get ready for this. And finally, on March 11th, WHO finally declared it as a pandemic. This is a different kind of virus than influenza virus, which has historically caused our previous worldwide epidemics. That's what a pandemic is. These coronaviruses are a real challenge in that we still have a lot we don't understand or know. Also, the other thing that's happening, and this is a perspective, let me just share some numbers, I think, that give you a sense. I'm very concerned about where we're at today and what I call shifting baselines. And that is basically becoming accustomed to or willing to accept something that just yesterday we wouldn't have. When this pandemic really began to take off in the United States, we hit a high of 32,000 cases reported every day in this country, mostly in the state and city of New York, Detroit, Chicago, New Orleans, some in Seattle and Southern California. But by Memorial Day, we got that number down to about 20,000 cases with all the actions that were taken. Now, some would argue 20,000 was a very low number, but we were sure feeling good. And then we went into the early summer months, and a combination, I think, of pandemic fatigue, pandemic anger, the sense that the pandemic wasn't real, and just those factors enhancing transmission, we watched the southern tier of states from California to South Carolina literally become the house on fire. And we went from 20,000 cases to 70,000 cases reported a day. Hardly believable when we thought that 32,000 cases a day was as bad as it's going to get. And then sure enough, we spent the better part of August working to try to get case numbers down, even though we had a number of intensive care units in throughout the southern states who were literally overwhelmed with the number of patients they had. And sure enough, by Labor Day, we got it back down to 26,000 cases reported a day. People were feeling pretty good about that. Again, we went through a whole series of, well, we kind of got this thing solved. It was the week after in Labor Day that, and I always say this not because it's to try to convince you that I know what's going on or don't going on, but I was shunned by a number of people when I suggested that it was very likely that by Thanksgiving we could be at 200,000 cases a day because people just did not envision what this virus could and would do. Well, in fact, on November 20th, we hit 200,000 cases a day. A house was on fire, a lot worse than it was at 70,000 or 32,000. But then again, the upper Midwest, which is where this activity was primarily located, all the efforts were put into place. Case numbers came back down. By December 1st, we're at 160,000, quite different base than we'd had in those previous months. Well, then it all lit back up again in those southern states from California to South Carolina. And on December 29th, we again crossed 200,000 cases reported a day. On January 8th, we hit 300,000 cases a day. And now, of course, today we're at about 125,000, 130,000 cases reported a day, which as a base, think of where that compared when we were a house on fire in July and April, how we've changed what we're thinking about what this pandemic is about. What I'm here to share with you today is I think the darkest days of the pandemic are yet to come. And I share that because of these new variants, these new mutated viruses that are surely causing a challenge that we had not had to deal with in the first 10 months of the pandemic. There are three areas that these new viruses really fall into. One, does it cause more transmission? Two, does it cause more severe illness? And three, can it in fact defeat the antibody protection of either vaccines or natural human infection? And we have mutations in these viruses that are causing all three of those to happen. One in particular, one called B117, or I'll call the UK strain, is one that we've had great concern about. It has created great havoc throughout Europe, where, in fact, the only thing that basically brought it under control was that terrible word, but a complete lockdown, closing almost everything. Even in London, before that was achieved and now starting to flatten the curve, the number of hospitalizations there, if equated to what it would be in the United States, was about 190,000 hospitalizations a day. We in November into January, hitting 130,000 hospitalizations a day, saw how much of our healthcare system overrun. So imagine what 190,000 would be like. Today in Portugal, which is also undergoing this terrible exacerbation and surge of cases due to this variant B117, the number of deaths there reported, if they were to be translated to here in the United States, would be about 10,000 a day, far in excess of the 4,000 a day we hit. And we were in January. So I think you can see the challenge we have relative to these countries that have seen this. This new mutant, B117, has now spread throughout the United States. We've had over 500 isolations of it. And in a system that is so basically incapable of responding to the sequence surveillance data we call testing these viruses. Right now, up until just the last week, we were 42nd in the world in sequencing viruses compared to all the other countries and knowing what was going on. Now, there are two other variants that have come up of concern. One is called P1 from Brazil. This is a story right now that has all of us on bated breath. We're trying to understand what's going on. And as I speak, literally, this is unfolding. There's a community known as Manaus, Brazil. And Manaus, located in the far northwestern region of Brazil, right at the headwaters of the Amazon River, in a city of 2.5 million people. Last year, last spring and summer, they had a major outbreak. It was truly a house on fire event. And at that point, they estimated that up to 75% of the population had been infected, mass graves frequently. Well, then they went through the rest of the summer with very little activity. They actually started publishing papers saying, we're pretty well done with this. Unfortunately, we took a heavy hit. And then this new variant, P1, emerged. Right now, Manaus is in the worst situation it's ever been. Many of the patients that they have are people who had illness last spring and summer, who had recovered and now are reinfected. And we know that this virus surely has the potential to evade the immune protection of the human response. How much it may evade the vaccine response, we don't know. But this P1 is a real challenge. We've just had P1 isolated here in Minnesota, a single case. We don't see it spreading widely, but this is another one that is a real concern. The final one is the South African variant that we've seen. It, too, has the ability to produce more illness, more transmission, but also to evade the immune response of both vaccines in the human population. There was a study just published this week showing the diminished response of the new J&J, Johnson & Johnson vaccine. However, fortunately, it appears that at least there was some protection. It was just the fact that there wasn't full protection from this. So we still have much more to learn. So what this really means is I think we have a real possibility of seeing a major surge of cases this fall into early winter here in Minnesota, throughout the United States, with this B117 strain, which if we do, I am convinced it'll be much more severe than anything we've seen to date. We surely in this country have a very large number of people who've been infected. Our estimate is that about 20 to 25% of the U.S. population has been previously infected. We have not seen so far in the UK strain the ability to, in fact, defeat the immune response of the human or the vaccine. That's good news. Unfortunately, yesterday, the Brits announced that they have now found the first B117 strains that have now acquired that mutation in England. So, again, this is changing literally by the hour in some cases as to what we're doing. Now, in terms of vaccine, you all heard about the vaccine so far. We believe it is a very highly successful vaccine, and we will continue to look at new vaccines as they come. When I say successful, meaning that the level of prevention of illness and particularly serious illness is very, very high, well into the 90% level. What will happen over the time, we don't know yet. What will happen if these new variants take over and what goes on there. So this is something we're monitoring. We would all like more vaccine. I can tell you that this is a huge challenge. We're trying to get people vaccinated as quickly as possible with a vaccine supply that is just not adequate to do that. You know, you can't make it out of whole cloth. If you plant 100 acres of corn, don't expect to harvest 500 acres, okay? It's just the reality. That's how much capacity we have to make vaccine. We're making it as quickly as we can. Some of us has proposed that we actually look carefully at moving to a first dose only and trying to vaccinate those over 65 years of age and then postponing the second dose until sometime later in the spring, early summer. I think the data will support that that actually is a very effective way to go. We're looking right now to have a national review of this to say it turns out with the first dose, we really do get remarkable protection. And that would mean we could get more of our over 65-year-old age group vaccinated, but that's a point that we're still working on at a national level. So let me just leave it and say, first of all, it's a privilege to be again before you, but also to be on the schedule here with my colleagues at State and Local Public Health. Having served 25 years there and having served two Republican governors, two Democratic governors, one independent governor, while I was there, it was always a real privilege. It didn't matter. It wasn't about politics. Public health was always about what's local and how you help those who are at a local level. So with that, I will close, Madam Chair. I'm happy to take any questions, comments, whatever. And again, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Osterholm. And I know probably people are always saying, we hope you're wrong, right?
I hope I'm wrong.
It would be good, but we sure can't count on that, man. Okay, we've got a number of members with questions. So just so members know, it's Quam, Grinhagen, Morrison, Freiberg is who I've got on the list now. So we'll start with Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding is that they were looking at a 12-week delay for the second dose in the UK, and they found some good indicators on efficacy. The J&J single dose appears to be better than the first dose of the others. Has there been analysis of doing a booster? And the UK and other countries are utilizing what Oxford, AstraZeneca, and what are the stages for that coming in? Thank you.
Yeah. Dr. Osterholm.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, thank you for that set of questions here. That is another hour, and I'll get into it. Now, I'll try to summarize briefly. First of all, the AstraZeneca vaccine that you talked about in the UK, there was a preprint published yesterday demonstrating that with a single dose, that was given with the idea of trying to vaccinate second dose 12 weeks later. They looked at the first 90 days after the first dose was delivered, and they found that the protection was the same throughout those 90 days, as well as the fact that the level of antibody was the same. One of the things I think it's important to understand about how these vaccines were arrived, Operation Warp Speed was truly a remarkable feat of government private sector coming together to bring us a vaccine that for just a year ago for a virus we hardly knew anything about. And the issue of trying to get that vaccine evaluated and approved was in a sense the approach taken was to minimize the amount of time that it would take to get all the steps done. So the dosing for these vaccines were at 3 and 4 weeks, respectively, for the two companies after the first dose. Most immunologists, people who study how the immune system responds in humans, would say, why would you ever do that? Because it's very possible you would not have had time to respond. Think of how many vaccines we have that it's months apart between your first dose and your second dose or subsequent doses, because the immune system does respond even more over time. And in fact, I've had a number of my colleagues say, I just didn't take my second dose at 4 months as opposed to 3 weeks or 4 weeks to get the best response. So, but they did that. And if they could find a difference, that was remarkable that the vaccine could respond that quickly. And we have every reason to believe that it's not going to drop off after 3 or 4 weeks. The response is only going to be more robust over time. So in that regard, that's why a number of us are feeling confident that even as you look at data going out, when we hear that the vaccine was 90 or 95% effective, we have every reason to believe that as time goes on, that it may only get more effective even after that. And that's exactly what happened with the Johnson & Johnson one-dose vaccine. The further out you got, the better the data looked in terms of prevention. So to make a long story short, we have a lot of work to do, and we're comparing different vaccines. All four of those vaccines I just mentioned, the J&J vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, and the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, are really all different vaccines. Moderna and Pfizer are using the same platform of messenger RNA, but the other two vaccines are different. And so that one of the challenges we have is we're all trying to get the same level of protection with different approaches. And so it's hard sometimes to compare one vaccine to the other in terms of how they perform from an immunologic standpoint. So, Representative, to summarize it, let me just say that there's a lot of work going on right now to understand these immune responses. There's a lot of work going on to understand if we encounter these variant viruses, how will that immune response work? For example, in South Africa with the J&J vaccine, they didn't prevent illness, but they prevented among those who had the variant infection, severe illness and death. Well, that's a pretty darn good thing if you've got one of these variant strains to get that. So the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have never been subjected to one of these variants. There were studies all done here in the United States before these variants ever took off. So we have a lot of work to do in this area, but and your questions are all right on the mark, and these are the kind of answers that we're attempting to arrive at to basically make sure we protect the public.
All right. Well, thank you. And members, just so we have five more questions now so far. So I'm not going to let people follow up, really. I'm just going to let you ask once, and then we'll, if there's time, we'll go around again. So Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. I do follow your comments and articles, and actually have two questions, but we'll see you. And the first one is this, you know, Dr. Fauci and yourself initially, and in fact, I quoted you on the House floor, said that mask wearing was not that effective. And yet now it seemed that things have changed in terms of your perspective on that. What I read and from experts is that the virus is small enough to go through the mask and therefore it doesn't provide much protection compared to like an N95. In addition to that, when we see the lockdowns and the restrictions, it seems like more open states like Texas, Florida, South Dakota, and do a lot better in terms of the death rate and even infections compared to California, New York, and even Minnesota. Just appreciate your perspective on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, first of all, on the mask issue, I have not deviated from day one on my position on that. Let me be very clear about that. Number one is the fact that when we talk about masks, unfortunately, we confuse several different types of respiratory protection. N95 respirators are very tight, face-fitting devices that we use in healthcare that actually has a blown, melted material, not a type of product that's like paper, that actually has the unique properties of allowing air to flow through it quite easily because of the size of the pores, but has an electrostatic charge in it. So it traps the viruses as they come through so that you can still breathe but get the virus through. You move to a surgical mask, or some call medical mask, which is actually more loose-fitting, and it has spaces along the face. This is the problem with face and face fit and face filtration. So you may stop the air in a sense of with the virus coming through in the cloth, but if you have spaces open here, basically as you breathe and you have resistance, it's just like swim goggles. When's the last time you put a swim mask on or swim goggles? They leaked at the glass. They leak at the fit. And so surgical masks are like that. Now, they can still reduce the amount of air that you take in or that you expel out that has virus in it. Then you get to the face cloth coverings, which are even less effective, but they still have effectiveness, meaning that basically, again, that tighter face fit, the cloth isn't nearly as able to filter out the virus as it comes through. But this is a cumulative issue. A dose is very important. It's not like lightning hits you and suddenly become infected. You have to be in an environment and you have to be exposed to that virus over a period of time. How many breaths do you inhale per minute? How much is in the air? And so think of it more like a car and safety, your seatbelt, your airbags, your, you know, collapsible wall panels. All these things contribute to safety. Not one of them is what saves you. It's all of them. So in terms of the N95 respirators, we've got to reserve those for our healthcare workers. Yep. We just need those. This is critical. Second of all, what my whole message has been, wear these devices, whether it be a surgical mask, but distancing is still important. It's time and dose. So, for example, when I go grocery shopping, I still go at 5 a.m. in the morning because it's, the to me, the safest time to be there. No one else is there. I have this run of the store to myself. Okay? And so do wear these masks, just knowing that they're much less efficient, but they still provide some protection that may be the protection that saves you from that trip to the store from getting infected. And so that's my position. It always has been. I know it's a complicated one, so it sounds like I am either for or I'm against. It's not true. I just be cautious for people who wear a face cloth covering and saying it. The last thing I have to say, and this was a tough one for me, I've done the study. We did a whole series of photographic images off the television at the evening news. And we looked at crowds. And we looked at them all around the country over time. Over 26% of the people wear it under their nose. Well, that's like fixing three of the five screen doors in your submarine. You know, that's not going to do any good at all. That's nothing more than a diaper on your face. And so that's the other part of it, is make sure you wear them correctly if you're going to wear them. In terms of the issue of what happens with deaths and numbers, you know, I can tell you right now, Southern California, Texas, Florida, their ICUs were overrun. They had many refrigerated semis out there to handle the bodies. We didn't have that. And I think that the same thing is true if you look at what happened in North and South Dakota. So, you know, I would respectfully disagree that they did better than we did. And when you actually look at the data, you will see that that's the case. Even still today, as I speak, Laredo, Texas right now still is using refrigerated semis because of the number of deaths that are occurring. And so remember the whole situation with the healthcare system. When you overwhelm the healthcare system, you not only are not providing adequate care to those who have COVID-19, but it's a time you don't want to have a heart attack, you don't have a stroke, you don't want to have to deliver a baby, you don't want to be in an automobile accident, and that's the challenge we've had. And today, I think that's the measure we use. Basically, we're not sitting here trying to keep all people from getting COVID-19. We're sitting here saying, when you do these restrictions, you're just merely trying to keep our hospitals from basically being incapable of providing even basic care. And that remains, I think, unfortunately, that. I do have to raise the question because it does beg what's going on with the science. If you go look at New Zealand, a country with 4.7 million people, Minnesota at 5.4 million people, we're not that different. Now, I agree they're an island, but they've had numerous introductions of this virus on their island. They've had 25 deaths. We're at 6,100. Is their science that much better than ours? No, but it's because their population was willing to comply with trying to get it shut down early, keep it down. And that's why today you can go and watch the Australian Tennis Open and see hundreds of people in the fan, in the stands, sitting next to each other, no masks on, no problem. That's the challenge we have today.
And Dr. Osterholm, before you get off the mask topic, you didn't mention anything about protecting other people.
Yes. Well, let me just say the theory originally put forward by the CDC on the use of face cloth coverings was because when I cough, I put out the virus, but also even when I breathe, we know that up to, you know, at least a third to maybe even higher percentage of the cases that occur when somebody is not even known to be infectious yet. They're not symptomatic, but they're breathing. And so what this is meant to trap is much of that material coming out, which there are data to support that happens. So it's not only, in a sense, protecting yourself when you have it on, but it's also, as you point out, Madam Chair, is it's also to helping protect others so that I don't spew my virus out nearly as much as it might be there if I didn't have this on.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Representative Morrison. So I have Morrison, Freiberg, Pryor, Ackland. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Osterholm, for being here and for your service to our state and country. You pretty much answered my question. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for teeing it up. I just want to be crystal clear that the less virus that is circulating, the less opportunity for mutations to arise. And so we're pretty open here in Minnesota. I know there's debate, but we're pretty open. And so I would love to hear from you. We should continue to wear masks that cover our nose and mouth in indoor public spaces and socially distance from other people?
We should. And the reason, Madam Chair, Representative Morrison, we should do that. And the reason in part is that what else is coming? You know, what's the base we're going to start from? And, you know, I'd rather fall off the curb than I'd rather fall off the roof. And I've already shared with you the baseline phenomena of how we just get more and more and more. So when you see the next surge accelerate, it's starting from a much higher baseline, which means we're already that much stretched. So you're absolutely right. The less virus is there. And that's why also we say get vaccinated now when you can, because, you know, if that virus can't exist in you because you're vaccinated and it's not one of those that basically is, in fact, a variant that causes that, then that virus can't mutate. It can't become another variant itself. So we want you to get vaccinated. We want you to protect as much as we can. And I can tell you that we are going to have another surge. And when it happens, the lower we start from, the better off we're going to be.
All right. Thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question was also similar to and was somewhat answered in Representative Grunhagen's remarks. I mean, what I heard, you know, what I heard Dr. Osterholm saying is just that the efforts that we put into, you know, that largely through executive action related to social distancing, mask wearing and so forth, and some of which we're now grappling with at a legislative level. But the measures that were put in place did prevent Minnesota from being worse off than it was. So in my mind, that speaks for the need to continue to consider measures like social distancing and mask wearing. And they certainly at the very least need to be encouraged, but you know, sometimes encouragement isn't enough and government action of some sort is necessary. So, I mean, I don't know if he has anything additional to say on that point. I'd certainly be interested in hearing.
No, I think, you know, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, you know, this is not a very becoming statement, but, you know, I don't know if I have any more tears left. I have dealt with so many situations, so many times where somebody thought I could just sneak this one as a family event. Somebody coming home from college, and then 3 weeks later, grandpa and grandma, mom and dad are dead. A number of people infected. I just got a very horrible email yesterday from a dear friend who refused to go to a football Sunday party at someone's house in this rural community. And now five of the individuals are all infected, and one of them is in the intensive care unit in critical condition. You know, people don't understand yet the implications of this and how this can transmit and what happens. And so, you know, we all want it to go away. You know, and I look to you, I look to the governor's office, you're all shock absorbers. You're trying to deal with a community that's rightfully upset, rightfully concerned, rightfully pained by what's happened economically, et cetera. And then we got the flip side of that, the what happens if we see these cases, what happens to your healthcare system? You know, just go spend a day talking to your healthcare providers who've had to spend countless hours. I just have to finish this last story because it's one of the reasons why. I had a colleague, an intensivist, a doctor in intensive care medicine who had done a number of rounds in Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. Boy, you can't get much more seasoned than this guy. And a few months ago, we were having a conversation one evening. He called and he broke down crying. He said, I can't do this anymore. That very day, he had to hold an iPad up to four different patients so their families could watch them die. You know, when you feel this, when you see this, and you look at these numbers, you realize what the consequences are. So, you know, I understand this is a challenge. This is hard. There's nothing easy about it, nothing. And, you know, when you are seriously ill, when your family is seriously ill, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or, you know, a Catholic or a Jew or a Protestant. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It doesn't matter even what age you are if you're seriously ill. And I think that's the point we have to keep. It's us versus the virus. And that's, you know, what we've got to keep focused on. It's just such an important piece. And, you know, we hope that these vaccines are going to get us a lot further along over time. But, you know, we've got to keep our eyes wide open and just keep focused on what we're trying to do.
Representative Pryor, do you want to follow that one?
Sounds like perfect timing for me to come on. Well, thank you, Dr. Osterholm. Good to see you again. It's been a while.
Thank you.
What you're telling is the darkest day may be ahead, and that we need to listen to that and realize that that's a possibility, as much as none of us wants that to be true, and how hard that is to hear it this afternoon, because I was getting kind of excited about the vaccine, but I'm not 65, so I can't. I can't be too excited yet. But what we're looking, we have to look ahead again, because what you said is this fall and this winter again. We also want to keep the baseline low, that we keep it from spreading in the community. So tell us about the things that we can still kind of look forward to as being relatively safe to be until we get to that 80% herd immunization. That might be some kind of protection right now. So like the outdoor, the distance, the mask wearing, I have 85-year-old parents and I want to see my grandkids. So tell me what I can do so that, all of us in Minnesota, how can we keep our mental health intact and our spirits up as we continue through this pandemic?
It's a heavy question.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, no, but it's right on the mark. It's right on the mark. You know, let's also make it very clear. The mental health of our society today is as frazzled as it's been in my entire adult life. I can't imagine it any worse. And as someone who has not spent a day indoors with my grandchildren since last March, it's hard. It's really hard. They're the love of my life. Now, we have gotten creative. It's a little hard to do with 3 to 5-year-olds who don't quite understand why they can't wrestle with grandpa. But, you know, we have been outside and, you know, we've been to parks and we've been to places where, you know, we are and stay 10 feet apart. And I feel safe about that. With my mask on, et cetera. And so we still see them. The issue of those who, particularly our mothers, it's about basically protecting yourself so you protect them. People who have planned literally to quarantine themselves for days before they had a Christmas event with grandma and grandpa. And you know what? They did it safely. They did that okay. So there's a lot we can do that can be very creative. And part of it is also just, I hate the term social distancing. Please just don't ever use it again. It's physical distancing. We should never socially distance, ever, ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the point that you're raising is really a key one. You know, I have found relationships that I saw people, you know, in person for years that unfortunately because of Zoom, I see them in a very different way, but I'm closer to them now than I've ever been. And I think that's what we have to do is reach out. And don't be afraid to use mental health services. I mean, if there was ever a time that we understand how important they are, it's now. And, you know, the first thing I did when that intensivist I told you about just now, I made sure, and he did, had an appointment with a therapist. You know, we're going through some tough times right now, really tough times. I'm very aware of a situation where a individual and I got involved with this situation. A 21-year-old college student came home for grandpa's birthday party, drove from another state to go home, unbeknownst had the virus. And as a result of her trip home, grandpa died. She was infected, didn't know it. and 2.5 weeks later, he died. The guilt that this young woman is carrying right now is beyond anything I can tell you. Mental health-wise, you know, she doesn't need a physical doctor right now in that sense. She needs help. So I think your point about the emotion and what this all does is absolutely critical. And so find creative ways. You can. Do acts of kindness. I know this is going to sound really crazy to many of you, but we actually have on our website, at a website for acts of kindness. We've started a pandemic of it, and that helps. I'm keeping track in my weekly podcast of the amount of light length. I can tell you exactly every day right now how much lighter it's getting. You know, find things like that. But you're right that we have to move on. You can't live as if there is no life to live. It's just a matter of how can we do it safely. One of the groups, by the way, we have a neighborhood group who decided to do Christmas caroling. And they literally spaced themselves outside more than 12 feet apart. They will take up an entire front lawn, and they have been going around caroling. And it's been remarkable. People just light up, you know, and they stay away from the front door. And so I think now's the time to find these creative ways to do things like this.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to Representative Ackland, and we have just 10 minutes left. So, Representative Ackland.
So, Dr. Osterholm, I guess on a lighter note, I would like to ask a more technical question. And this is regarding the variants. And you said there was one P1 case in the United States and I think 500 of the B117s. And my question was, is there, when you're doing your routine testing for COVID and they're running the test on it, can you actually see the variant at that point? Or is there something that triggers the tester to look further to actually see if it's the COVID that we have in our community or if the variant has arrived? And the other question I had is that P1, one case, what part of the United States is that in?
Dr.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I'll just tell you right now, P1's right here in Minneapolis. This is where we found it. So it was from the State Health Department's work. When you actually go in and get tested, there are several different testing devices that will be doing what we call polymerase chain reaction testing, PCR testing, that are looking for certain genetic targets on the virus to pick up. In several of the tests use the spike protein gene, basically. They're looking for that. And with the situation with the P117, that is absent. So when you get a test that the other two targets are sky high and the S gene is negative, you know you got a good chance that this is that variant, okay? Now, for the other variants, that may not be the case. And so what we have to do is actually collect these samples routinely, and the State Health Department has been the leader here in Minnesota. We've actually had other commercial labs that do this, and now we are starting a whole new system in the United States to actually routinely collect those, a percentage of them, and just test them. Right now, we weren't doing that. And so then you have to do what we call genetic sequence, and you have to sequence the entire virus to find out, okay, what is this one all about? What is it of? And there are many different variants, but the ones we're concerned about are the ones that do one of those three things, either transmit more effectively, cause more severe illness, or in fact, actually evade the immune response that I just talked about. And that's what we're really looking at right now. And I would just say the P117 or the UK variant is one I'm most concerned about. That is spreading widely through the United States. If we look at the other countries in Europe that have seen literally house on fires events, in every instance, this P11 started to transmit for several weeks to a month or more in the country, kind of quietly, and all of a sudden it took off. I worry that we might be in that very same early stage here about to take off. And that's how we get that. So you're going to see the CDC has come online now with much, much more in the way of helping to do this genetic sequencing surveillance system. There's lots of private labs, academic labs, for example, that can do the sequencing and will give us much better data on what we're seeing and not seeing.
Thank you. And before I go to Representative Gruenhagen, just a good time to note that we have an excellent public health lab in this state that we're very proud of. And you know, who knows? Maybe that's why we say, oh, Minnesota has this variant. It might be that we just found it, right? It's kind of.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. 100% on target. Exactly right.
Yeah. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks again, Dr. Osterholm, for being here and for your testimony. We don't get a chance to ask questions of people of your caliber very often. So the other person I follow on this is Dr. Scott Jensen, and he was a former state senator. And he's raised a concern that our Department of Health has issued information on changing the way death certificates are filled out to actually highlight more COVID deaths than what they actually passed away from. I've actually had constituents who called me in my own district that they experienced that with their parent or grandparent who passed away. Again, all deaths are tragic. Yeah. He also shared that if a hospital reaches 161 deaths, they get a $77,000 bonus per patient or per patient that's deceased. And so there's almost a financial incentive to fill out death certificates in a way that attributed to COVID, even though that's not the primary cause. Representative France and Representative or Dr. Jensen did an audit of about 2,800 death certificates from the department, and they found that 40% of those death certificates were falsely blaming COVID for the primary reason for death, when something else was really the primary cause. What are your thoughts about that, Dr. Osterholm?
Dr. Osterholm.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's simply not true. Clear, cut, and calm, not true. Let me be really straightforward on this issue, because this is a tough one. When someone has an underlying health condition, it's very real, it's there, but that's not what they're dying from. Let me give you an example. I live somewhere where there's this incredible brush coverage in the forest all around my home. It's been there for years, hasn't burnt for years. Oh, and by the way, now we have the lowest humidity ever recorded on record. And by the way, did I tell you that the temperature is 110 degrees? And did I tell you that the winds are 60 miles an hour? You know what? All of those real, but my house doesn't burn down. It doesn't burn down until somebody puts a match in that wood, and then it goes. COVID virus is the match that otherwise these people wouldn't have burned down. They wouldn't have died, even though they had these conditions. It made them much more likely once it happened. If I lived in a house that was surrounded by concrete and didn't have a tree within, you know, a mile and nothing, a very little chance that a match would burn my house down. So let's be really clear about this. As far as reimbursement, these cases are very complicated. The care, medical care for a patient who has COVID is complicated and as difficult as we see in medicine. We're going to learn more in the world of medicine from caring for these patients about our human immune system, about how basically viruses directly affect us and how our own immune system causes our major problems. And so if you just look at the care that's required for these patients, it's dramatically different than we see with somebody just coming in with a heart attack. And so I think the challenge also on reimbursement has never been about an incentive. And I think most physicians, if not almost all physicians, would actually find that a repugnant suggestion that they would somehow orchestrate, engineer, or somehow deal with the death certificate to get more money. That's just simply not the case. And these rumors continue, but it's not. I think that the physicians of Minnesota have done a remarkable job. They are our heroes. They are on the front lines day after day doing just like I said that intensivist did. And I think that's really an important message to get out.
Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. And you know what? I also find that to be a repugnant suggestion. So thank you for putting it that way. I'm going to ask you the final question. I think it kind of fits right in here. We've talked a lot about deaths, but we haven't talked much about health impact for people who survive COVID. And, you know, the more we learn, it seems like this could be something that goes on for a long time. And I wonder if you'd have any comment about that aspect of this, too.
Madam Chair, I think this is a huge issue, as we call this condition long haulers condition. We're now seeing a very substantial number of patients various numbers, 20 to 30% of patients who have this infection who may not be critically ill at the time that they get it. They often can be younger. And yet by the 10th week out, they are literally unable to go to work, even though they had gone to work in the time period between the initial infection and now. It's very similar to that of chronic fatigue syndrome, except we have clear and compelling evidence of damage to the lungs, damage to the heart, and we believe that's an immune response. It's not the virus still growing inside of you. And we don't know how long these are going to last, how bad they are. So you'll be hearing a lot more about long haulers condition for a long time to come. And I think that one of the challenges we have today, particularly for the younger population who dismiss this as an old person's disease, you know, it's nothing bad going to happen to me. If they could watch these long haulers, I have personal friends who right now are home and on oxygen, who are young, previously healthy adults who basically aren't able to do or function as they once were. I don't know what their long-term prognosis is. Medical science doesn't know right now, but it's another reason why you don't want to get this virus infection. And long haulers is going to be one of the hallmark outcomes besides what we think of when we think of the very severely ill patient in the hospital.
Well, Dr. Osterholm, thank you so very much. I know everyone on the committee really appreciates your appearance today, and thank you so much for the work you do for us in the state of Minnesota and in our country, and I'm sure the world, because I know you are out there, you know, one of the preeminent experts in the field, and this obviously is something that is so concerning to all of us. So with that, members, thank you, and the committee is adjourned.